Hey, welcome to the River Talk podcast, hosted by Priscilla Macy, Zach Collier, and me, Eric Weiseth. This week, we are going to the mailbag for the emails we've got. We got one great one that I think is going to spawn a bit of a conversation. Priscilla is off doing Priscilla-type things, but she may hop in the middle of this thing. So if all of a sudden you hear her, it's because she decided to grace us with her presence. But we usually like to start off with news of the week. So, Zach, do you have any news of the week?
I don't, but I have a conundrum or a question to ask you based on paddling this week. And this is from a friend. I'm asking for a friend who went to the white salmon to do the middle white salmon, which is a run that's like class 3+. It's low water right now. And he forgot his helmet and had his bike helmet in his car and wasn't sure if it'd be safe to wear his bike helmet. What would you do? Would you just not go boating with your friends, or would you wear the bike helmet?
Damn, that's a good question.
And it's a run he knows well. He does it often. He knows the lines, and so it's like a pretty straightforward thing.
So just to confirm that we're talking about the same thing.
Yeah.
We're not talking about a rafter. We're not talking about an inflatable kayaker. We're talking about like a hard boater.
Hard boater. Yep.
Yep. Okay. I think caveat this that like, in my opinion, use a helmet that's made for the thing that you're doing.
Yep.
So don't ride a motorcycle with a bike helmet. Wear helmets that are appropriate for the activity and designed with the activity that you're doing in mind. Don't bike with kayaking helmets, etc. That said, in this scenario, if I live 20 minutes away and kayak this every day or like three times a week, I probably would just go home because you're going to look like an idiot. But if it was, I drove, an hour to get there, I don't get to do it very often or whatever, I would throw my bike helmet on and go, personally. Especially in that run, because like that run, if you know the run, you can most likely, if you're a solid, class 4- boater, you can probably do it without flipping over, especially if you run conservative lines. I would probably go in my bike helmet.
So you would personally go or you wouldn't go?
It would sort of depend on the scenario, right? Like if I had traveled to do this, I don't get to do it all the time. Like it's not like my backyard run, I do it 4 times a week. If it was my backyard run, I do it 4 times a week, I'd probably just go home. But if it's something, I'll do 5 times a year, I travel to do it with my friends, I'm excited about doing it, and I had a bike helmet in my car, I'd probably go and just run it conservative.
And is the reason you wouldn't go is because you would look dumb because it's a bike helmet, or you think it's maybe unsafe?
It's probably a combo of both.
Okay.
And it would depend on the run too. And how my boating was and all that kind of stuff. But generally I would probably on that run probably go. Although that said, like in low water, I'd feel less excited about it. I'd probably put in below, the first rapid there or below the top part of it. It would affect the choices I make that day if I did go for sure. Because you're not going to have some of the protection on the side of your head that maybe you have on a lot of your kayak helmets. You're not, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But, crap. Like, people used to kayak in football helmets. So, they mostly turned out okay. Except for the ones that didn't, I guess. I don't know.
So he went.
Zach, what did he do?
He went, and it looked dorky.
Yeah,
and
for sure.
And it was a subject to conversation with everybody who was on the river that day.
That it was.
But he didn't flip, and it was fine, and it was fun.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's – I could totally see me making that same call. Of just like, if you were in an IK on that stretch and showed up and forgot your helmet and didn't have a bike helmet, just didn't have a helmet, would you go?
I'd still go, yeah.
Yeah, me too.
Sure. IKs, I can say with a high level of confidence I'm not going to flip in an IK.
What if you're okay with thigh straps or without?
Either way, don't think I would flip in an IK. But in a hard shell, when you flip, your head's exposed to rocks. In an IK, when you flip, you just fall out on your butt.
Not if you have thigh straps on, though.
Oh, because you're saying you might go head first. Oh, you're saying more likely to wear a helmet if you have thigh straps on.
Yeah, if I didn't have my helmet, I would, especially on that run, I probably wouldn't wear my thigh braces.
Oh, that's interesting.
I would probably go, that's my rule now. I for decades haven't worn a helmet in an IK most of the time. But you know, I mean, it depends on the run, right? But if I'm out in a class three or like low four run, I'm probably not wearing a helmet in an IK a lot of the time. But if I put thigh braces on, I put on a helmet, because same thing as in a hard shell, you flip over, your head becomes the lowest thing almost every time.
Yeah. Oh, I never would have thought about that. I would have thought I would be less likely to, like, if I had thigh braces, I'd be less likely to wear a helmet because I'm more likely to stain with thigh braces.
True. I agree with that part. Like, it's sort of that calculus. But if you do flip, you know, if I flip without thigh braces, the likelihood my head is the lowest thing is almost zero. If I go the other way, it's the exact time.
I'm here.
Hey,
I got to bail off for just a sec, guys.
Oh, cool. So, Priscilla, Eric has to go do some thingy with we just opened up the podcast, and then Eric just snuck out.
Oh, okay.
To do something. So your timing is really good. I was asking if we were just doing news of the week. We had nothing. But I had a theoretical question about I have a friend that went to the White Salmon last week. We were paddling in the middle, and he forgot his helmet, but had his bike helmet.
Oh.
So would you paddle the White Salmon with a bike helmet?
The middle? Yeah.
Okay.
But I wouldn't do the truss, I don't think. And I guess it depends on like how good of a bike helmet it is, because really they're kind of made out of the same things when you dissect them. But I guess for me, like a kayak helmet covers a little bit more of your head. So if there's a chance I'm going to be upside down, or if it's on a run with a lot of rocks and whatnot, I'd probably not want to wear a bicycle helmet. But the middle, yeah, I wouldn't feel bad about doing that.
Would you do the Arletta?
I'd think about it. Yeah. Because there's a couple spots there that have a bunch of rocks. So I guess I'd see what the water level was and what the chances were of me flipping in some of the spots you'd want a helmet.
So some of... I took an International Rafting Federation class. I think I told you this. And one of the things early on he told us was about gear and helmets in particular. And he was really clear that whitewater, the helmets for whitewater are very specific to whitewater. They're made for taking certain impacts that you have in whitewater, and that like bike helmets are constructed very differently for a very different type of hit.
Hmm. Like so, even mountain biking helmets?
Yeah. Yeah. I forget exactly what he said, but he was just very clear that like for whitewater, you need to use a whitewater specific helmet.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I guess that makes sense. And just they're definitely heavier, and there's more robust plastic on the outside, where I think generally bike helmets have more holes and whatnot. So, yeah, I think if you probably hypothesize flipping over and hitting a rock, maybe just run shuttle that day. But, you know, obviously if you're doing a run where it's really deep and you're probably not going to hit any rocks, like, I don't know, say the Scott River or the Klamath River or something. Like if you flip over, you're just going to be in deep water. Like, I don't know. I wouldn't put too much weight on it.
This is the middle White Salmon, and it was low. Yeah. It was like 1.1 feet, I think. So low. So if you flipped over, you might hit your head. But he also really wanted to go because his friends were there and there's just people he wanted to hang out with. So it's, you know, running shuttle would have been a bummer.
Yeah. I probably would have just been like, yeah, wear your bike helmet for that run. So I don't have too much news of the week. I just know that American Whitewater's Chelan Gorge release is this weekend. So it is up in Chelan, or near Chelan, Washington. And I've never been, but I'm going this year and excited to check it out and be a part of paddling something that AW and others worked pretty hard to get going.
Priscilla, how hard is the Chelan Gorge? I've seen some video and it looks hard.
Yeah, so it's class 5. But the nice part about it is you can easily scout and portage a lot of the harder ones. And it's really short. So I think it's a half a mile. So the rapids are difficult, but you don't have to run all of them. And you can take your time. There's I believe it's a 6-hour window of time when they're letting the water out. So you have 6 hours to figure out a half a mile of whitewater with a big group.
Could a class 4 boater go there and just portage everything big?
I don't think so, because there's a couple boulder gardens at the end that I think you have to run. Again, I haven't been there, so this is just from reading trip reports and asking folks that are difficult boulder gardens. So I think you'd want to feel comfortable running some class 5 to be able to get down there safely.
Cool. Well, I'm excited to hear more about it when you get done.
Yeah, I'm excited to check it out. So I see that we have some mail. So we got a couple questions from Mitch. I'll just read them. So I had a few questions I thought I'd shoot out to the podcast. First one, do petitions make an impact from an advocacy standpoint? I'm sure all of you have signed Barefoot Brad's petition to stop the potential mining plans in the headwaters of the North Fork Smith. After I did that, I was wondering if any of those things actually work. And if they are not the best way, what would work better? I work at a paddle sports retailer and connect with hundreds of paddlers a week. I was thinking I could make more out of my interactions by giving people an opportunity to advocate for the places they paddle. For those of you who run guided trips, I'd also think that someone getting off a Chetco trip or an Illinois trip would also be a prime candidate for a new river advocate if you were somehow able to point them in the right direction and provide ideas of how they could advocate for beautiful places we paddle. If you guys have any ideas for me, let me know. So I think we can probably give some ideas for the first question before going on to the second one. For me and my experience lobbying and doing some advocacy work, I don't know that petitions do as much as other forms, including calling legislators, writing letters, showing up to public meetings and those sorts of things. Doing the Every Action forms from Outdoor Alliance or American Whitewater. I think what petitions can do, though, is they can bring attention to a topic or a concern, and depending on where those petitions are sent, whether it's sent to a legislator or a local group or wherever it ends up going, it can demonstrate to them that something's important and people in their area or constituents of theirs are motivated enough to sign on to a petition. I don't know if you have any experience with that, Zach, or can speak to how effective petitions are or other types of advocacy.
Well, a good rule of thumb is the more effort you put in, the more effect it makes. So the least amount of effort is signing a petition online. Then next is like signing a real petition. And then next is like maybe a letter to a representative, then calling a representative, then visiting a representative, then going to DC. So the more effort you put in, the more effect it has. So they have some effect. Barefoot Brad's petition is awesome, and but he's continually doing it, and it's a useful tool. The times petitions matter are when the legislator, like the senator or congressperson, says, "Hey, I need cover. I need you guys to get 10,000 signatures." And he'll go to a nonprofit group and say, "Hey, I need you guys to come. I need you guys to get me some sort of cover." And that's when they might ask for signatures. Or there's some sort of legislative process that requires public support or comment. And so that's where the nonprofit groups like American Rivers, American Whitewater, for example, really help, because they're in direct touch with these legislators. And the legislators are saying, get us 5,000 signatures. And that's why you get the action alert sometimes is from them. Mm-hmm. So I would say, like, as a paddle sport retailer, having your own petition maybe wouldn't really help. But what you could do effectively is call the offices sometimes and just say, tell them things you care about. It's super easy to make that phone call. It's less intimidating than you think. Or encourage people to join a nonprofit, because those nonprofits have their ear to the ground and they're having these direct relationships. And those nonprofits can go to the legislator and say, hey, we have 10,000 members and we had a petition signed with 500 people signing it. We do care about this place. So I think if you're asking what you could do, you could individually call representatives and you could join a group and encourage other people at the store to join the relevant group as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think, since you have a job and I'm sure other things that you have to be doing, your time might be limited. And it seems like you want to use your limited time in a more powerful way to interact with customers, something you could do that would connect them to a wide network of advocates or advocacy groups is tell them about American Whitewater or a group that's specific to, say, like the Calmeopsis or something like that, and let them know, like, hey, this area is threatened by XYZ, and this group is doing something to deal with that. If you enjoyed paddling on this stretch of water and you want to continue to see it free flowing and pollution free or whatever the narrative is, consider joining this group or consider doing more research about it and seeing if you can contribute ideas or manpower to this advocacy effort. Yeah. But I think trying to take it on as an individual is really daunting. And so using the resources that groups like, say, Outdoor Alliance and American Whitewater have really helps maximize your time as a volunteer, because they can then say, oh, we already have this group of people working on this, and these are the legislators we're working with, and this is what you can do, versus you trying to go through a black hole of tons of information and network of who to talk to and when to talk to them.
Yeah, yeah. And a 5-minute phone call to a legislator is invaluable. It's so useful. So I highly recommend it. On the note of the Calmeopsis, I was kind of unhappy with the way that the Calmeopsis has been being represented. So a few of us started the Calmeopsis Guides Association last year. It's our own nonprofit, so that we could get members and have a voice to represent protecting the Illinois, the Chetco, North Fork of the Smith. And so you could also start a nonprofit to represent the places you love. And we raised about $3,000 last year, which sent three river guides to DC to advocate for these places. And so if you are looking for an organization to support, we'd happily take more members for that one. And I'll put a link in the show notes to that one. But I've seen, through my experience, I've seen that direct relationship with the legislator is the most important thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And remembering too, that, you know, something that I find I run into with people having some confusion is, well, which legislators do I talk to? Yeah. And most people just like think, oh, DC legislators, members of Congress are the people that make all the decisions. Sometimes like our state level legislators have a lot of influence when it comes to management decision making as well. So it's always important to, I like to think about if this is something that you end up wanting to do or a customer's curious about it, is finding the list of legislators for the state of Oregon or the state of Washington or whatever state you're talking about the river being in, and finding what district that person or you lives in and connecting with your own legislator, both at your state and in U.S. Congress. And then also, where is the section of river that's threatened, in what district does that align with both those legislators as well or more? So it's always good to, when you're making a call to a legislator, it really means a lot if you live in their district and you're a voter, of course. And then it also matters if you're someone that is a paddler and you really want, say, the Illinois River to be protected or advocated for, figure out who that legislator is, both at the state level and at the U.S. Congress level, and communicate that to them.
And it depends if it's on the river you care about in particular, on the where it's at. If it's on federal public lands, it's not going to help much to go to a state legislator. Yeah. But if it's like the Hood River, for example, which is, you know, mostly private land, and then it might make sense to go to a state legislator. So you kind of need to learn about the landscape of the area. If there's a place you care about, some people are just like, hey, how can I help? Like, they don't have a particular cause. They just want to help river conservation in general. That's where joining a group makes sense. If there's a specific river you care about or a specific cause, then you want to go find who's working on it and just get involved. And then call your representative, whether it's a federal or state, depending on where that river is.
Mm-hmm. And if you can't do any of that, just join American Whitewater.
American Whitewater is hands down, in my experience, the best nonprofit for river conservation. It's just, they're amazing.
So hopefully that helped out. If we missed anything or that seemed too convoluted, feel free to shoot us another email or message or Facebook or whatever works best for you. So we'll go on to the second question. How hard is it to get a put in or take out built/installed? I know AW has made it happen with BZ Corner, Canyon Creek, and many others. The upper wind is a stretch in my mind that could use a takeout or put in after the class 4 stuff. There's a pretty obvious transition about halfway through the run where it switches to class 3. My thought is that the lower half of the upper wind could be more utilized to class 3 boaters looking for a good intro into creeking run. The other positive is that the upper half could be run down to 4 feet in a kayak instead of 5 feet, and you could actually make more laps in a day. Parentheses, we usually cut off at 5 feet because the lower half gets bony. Anyway, I know most think it's 100% gorged out most of the run, but actually right after the last class 4, after about a quarter mile on the left-hand side and a nice gradual slope that I've hiked out before to be able to get a second lap. You pop out on the road right by the National Forest border sign, and I've heard back in the day you had to run the truss to run the middle white or pay some drunk guy. It would just be cool to have access to more people on this beautiful river. How would I advocate for this? Or if there's a better spot for a put-in or take-out that would see a lot more use, where would that be and how could a paddler advocate for that? So there's kind of a lot involved in this, and it depends also in what state you're in. So in Washington, I'm not as familiar with the processes on stuff that happens outside of national forest land, but typically what happens if you're doing any sort of construction or building of trail or infrastructure within a national forest is you may have to go through a NEPA, which is an environmental assessment of the impacts of that type of construction, which is a pretty arduous process typically. So it takes a long time. It's kind of spendy for the Forest Service. So it might be difficult to do that. Again, it's certainly possible, especially if you have advocacy groups behind your back saying it's something that's needed. And you have a bunch of local paddlers or whatnot saying that they would use it. If you're doing it, so there is a lot of private property along the Wind River. But there are scenarios where, say, agency or a nonprofit group could purchase that property if it was offered for sale and change it into an access point. There's obviously a lot involved in that, so the steps would be different in each scenario. What's the other part? So on Canyon Creek, the interesting story about that is it had to do with the hydropower project and the same thing that happened on the Clackamas. So on rivers where you have hydropower projects, you are sometimes able to utilize money from, say, PGE to improve access as a part of how they kind of mitigate the impacts of the hydropower projects by improving river access or other things like that. So I think with Canyon Creek and with like the Clackamas River, that was something that American Whitewater and other stakeholders negotiated with PGE. So that would not apply on the Wind, but it's an option for other rivers. Zach, do you have any other thoughts about access?
I think that this access he's talking about, the Wind, would be tough. My guess is some private land, and that just kind of ends the discussion right there. So I think that one's tough. I know here in Hood River, I want better access for the hood. The hood has terrible access. And I know if, I've been told I can go advocate to the county and work on that. I just haven't done it yet. And somebody needs to do it. That's the hood, somewhere where we can get things done. But I would say if you could start by doing the research, like find out whose land it is. Is it public land, private land? And then if it's on public land, go to the Forest Service and talk to them. Say, hey, what can we do to get access? And they're going to tell you a bunch of reasons they can't do it. And then you just move up the chain, move up to higher levels, and then work with American Whitewater and say, hey, this is important to a number of paddlers. That's a good reason to do a petition, like just as a citizen, say, hey, I have 300 paddlers that want, access. It's not just me. That might help get something started, whether you take it to American Whitewater and get them involved or somebody else. But it's a lot of work. That would be a tough mm-hmm. one. It's tough to get access, better access.
Yeah. But just because it's tough doesn't mean it's not worth pursuing. It's just, it'll be a learning opportunity.
You'd be a hero, Mitch. You would be an absolute hero. I would love to have better access on the wind. But if I was to choose access right now, it would be on the hood. We just barely have access to the Hood River. And I'd love to see somebody step in and make some phone calls and go to meetings and help us get better access for the hood.
Yeah, I'm back now. I will say that if you could get access where he's talking about, I think the wind would become, the wind's already sort of a classic run, and it would become one of like the premier runs around, because like I used to avoid doing that just because I got so sick of that bottom part.
Okay.
So if you could do the upper part without that, that'd be amazing.
I didn't want to address this part of his email, but now that you brought it up, I'm going to just have fun on the class three. It's kind of snobby to want to just do the class four. Like, enjoy the class three. There's like play spots and it's beautiful and you can bring lunch. Like, I don't know. And if there was access below wet spot, it probably wouldn't be for rafts.
Wouldn't be? Yeah, no, I think
this kayak, it would be kayak only. The one thing I have to say is he's right though. It's a great put in for class three boaters. And it would make it a great place for people like to do something different class three for sure. But to say that you don't do the upper wind because you don't like the class three at the end, Eric, that's snobby. Sorry, I didn't mean to call you snobby. But
no, I mean, that's fair. If you're evaluating what run to do, it plays into it. Okay. Or how much time you have. That's another way to look at it, too.
Yeah.
If I've got a really tight window, is there a run where either that, I can do that shorter or that is more focused on a higher percentage of the run is stuff that's really good.
Yeah. So, no, I hear you.
But anyway, my opinion on this one would be there's nothing you can do until you figure out who owns the land that you want to get on.
Yeah.
Like you've got to figure that piece out. Is it public or is it private? Because the route you're going to go is totally different depending on the answer to that question. So figure out who owns the land. And then go for there. But yeah, you'd totally be a hero.
And I would sign your petition. Status. Yep. I would sign your petition in a heartbeat.
Yeah. We would advocate for your petition here with our many listeners of our podcast.
Yeah. Both of them would sign both of them would sign your thing.
Yeah. So cool. Well, shall we move to gear of the week?
Yeah.
Awesome. Priscilla, do you have any gear of the week?
Yes. I don't know if I said this one already, but these chairs have existed for a really long time. They're just kind of like the classic foldable like cloth chair. But I got without legs. So I got one that can fit in the back of a kayak if you want to. And it has, instead of just having like kind of a butt cover, you can flip it out and it has a leg cover too. So like, if you don't want pine needles on your legs or whatnot. And I think it's awesome and it barely takes up any space if you are needing to like pack a bunch of people in a car to do a road trip or, you just don't want a bunch of bulky stuff. And, I guess the only downside is if it gets wet, like in your boat or whatnot, and it's not a particularly warm day, it doesn't really dry out that quickly because it's canvas, but I really like it for summer trips. And what is mine? It's like the Mountain Smith. I can't remember the name of the model, but
we'll put it in the show notes on the website.
Yeah.
Cool. Zach?
So my gear of the week is my new raft. I'm pretty excited about it. I haven't taken it out yet, but Wing, I probably told you guys.
I haven't boated it yet, but I really.
But I love it.
No. It looks cool, and everybody who sees it is like, that boat looks cool.
Most important part.
Yeah. So Wing is making whitewater rafts again. I think I mentioned that. And I had them, I designed a 13-foot raft based on an Adventure. So it's like an Avon Adventure, but with pretty big tubes still. It's like, I think it's 22-inch tubes for 13, which is a big tube. But like a little smaller than an Adventure, a little narrower, a little shorter. And I got it in matte black, which just looks so cool. And I totally know that it's going to get heat up in the sun and it's going to be a terrible summer boat. But this boat looks amazing. So I'm pretty excited about it. I might even take it out today. So my gear of the week is Wing's new 13-foot raft design.
And is this something that like someone could just go buy, or is this like this is Zach Collier Wing Best Friend special?
No, they gave it a name. They named it something. I mean, if you called them,
is it the Collier?
No, it's it's something else. I don't know. I don't think it's not even
That's
their website.
Too bad.
It's not on their website yet. I designed a bunch of boats for them, and I tried to name the 16-foot raft was the first one, and I tried to name it Praetorian because it just sounds really cool. And they decided to name all their boats after people that work there, which is respectable. So when I saw the invoice for this boat, it had a name on it, but I can't remember what it was.
Like Steve or something?
Something like that. Like give me a Steve. So Wing has a they have a 12-foot 9 boat that I don't think is a very good design. So you wouldn't want that one. This is just a 13, just classic boat. So I'll try to put a photo of it up on the website so you guys can see it.
I'm excited to see it.
Yeah.
Sweet. Awesome. My gear of the week, I kind of had one piece, well, kind of two. So one, this summer increased my appreciation of bearing buddies on trailers. So if you're running a raft trailer, a drift boat trailer, a boat trailer, and even if you're not putting it in the water when you load, unload stuff, but if you're towing a trailer a lot, have bearing buddies on your trailer. And basically what they are is it's a little attachment that goes on to the hub there where you can squirt grease in throughout the summer, like as you're doing it, not having to pack your bearings over and over to help prevent your bearings from blowing out and destroying your axle and causing you to be stranded places. So,
okay, this is amazing. Buddies. I never knew this existed. I'm going to buy some right now.
They're called bearing buddies?
Bearing buddies.
That's awesome.
And like, if you have a trailer that, even like they really use them primarily on like, you know, boat trailers where like, you know, your wakeboarding type boats where you're putting the trailer in the water, like the axles, wheels are going in the water. Mm-hmm. For those, they're like essential because the water will, you know, the grease gets washed out or whatever. So you're putting grease in all the time. But we don't typically do that with our raft trailers, but just for overall wear and tear, because we put so many miles on them. You know, then like 5-6 times a summer, you take a grease gun, attach it to the end, squirt grease in, and you're good to go. It keeps your bearings going longer between repacks and decreases the likelihood you blow your bearings out.
These are only $25 a pair on Amazon.
Yeah, they're not expensive. No, it's like, it's not rocket science. Like, people have been doing it forever. Like, this isn't, nobody's mind should be blown by this. And yet, Eric, I kind of forgot about them, and they're game, like they're awesome. You should definitely have them on your boat trailers.
My mind is blown. This is the single best thing this podcast has ever done for my life. This moment right now.
Well, I'm glad to hear it. So
they even have bras. They have Bearing Buddy bras.
Yeah, no, you want those for sure.
Yeah, no, I'm in.
Yeah, Bearing Buddies. Bearing Buddies are rad. And then the other one I wanted to follow up on, because I think I talked about it at the beginning of the summer, because we just got them in, was the new Canyon Cooler Navigator, which is their like big 155 that they really designed specifically around a raft frame. They took the Prospector 105 version and just like big sized it, but with some really cool features to it. We bought a bunch and used them commercially this summer. I was on a couple trips with them to see how they hold ice and stuff. And they are rad, like flat out rad. They hold ice unbelievably well. The features, like the way they're designed to sit in a raft frame and where the drain plugs are, all of it. Like they're just really, really well thought out. And they're big enough to be a commercial cooler. Hmm. You know, like, could they be a little bigger? Probably, but they're right there with kind of what those big NRS ones were a couple of years back, that they claimed were a 170. They're very similar dimensions to those. So I was super stoked. I think, you know, there's like all things, there's one or two little things to not or to question the durability of, but like 95% rad would be my take on those.
So first of all, Eric, you mentioned Canyon coolers before the summer. So I ended up buying two and love them. Did the smaller ones for different uses, but thank you for that earlier in the year. I'm looking at this right now on the internet and they put mm-hmm. the drain plug in the front, which is.
And the side. They're both.
Brilliant.
Yeah. So that was like one of the things I love about it is that specific feature to drain your coolers in the middle of the drip. Yeah. You don't have to like do that shuffle in the morning. Yeah. Where you're like, all right, well, let's pick them up, put them on the bar, drain them, put them back in. All that backbreaking effort is gone. They're right there in the middle. You could do it while you're rowing the boat in the middle of the day. You just reach down, like,
yep.
Unscrew it, let the water come out, screw it back in, and you're good to go. Like it's like the dumbest thing that is so genius for day-to-day rafting.
You can fill up your water jug with cold water anytime you want to.
If you're into drinking like melted ice water out of your cooler. Personally, not my jam, but you know, you do you. Yeah. So anyway, we used them. I was a big fan. I thought they're cool. Just really clever from top to bottom. And they seem to be proving really durable. So that is my gear of the week.
Sweet.
Awesome. Well, unless you guys have anything else.
No, yeah. I think we really did a good job this time.
Well, we'll see. Anyway, thanks for checking out the River Talk podcast. Please email us your thoughts, questions, comments, rants to therivertalkpodcast@gmail.com. So that's the River Talk Podcast. So THE at the beginning of that. RiverTalkPodcast@gmail.com. And otherwise, hopefully you're going out boating, finding somewhere to go, a little bit of water that's hiding around until we come. And we'll see you next week. State of mind. I'm on Chattahoochee on the